the contribution of the Yemeni Women's Technical Advisory Group, so-called, which has been with us in the talks and between the talks, has already been valuable during the Stockholm consultations, and it should provide a basis to reach out much more broadly to Yemeni women who remain in their homes, in the front lines, looking after their families. In April, last month, I met with the eight representatives of that technical advisory group in Scotland, in the United Kingdom, where they generated ideas with us for the comprehensive peace agreement on how to maintain stability in Yemen during the post-agreement phase. And they came with great difficulty to the United Kingdom. From traveling from Yemen is not a simple matter, nor is it often a safe matter. I would like to record my gratitude to them for the risks they take and for the advice they give. And again, we will depend on that relationship as we move into reviewing the political options to resolve this conflict. I would like to emphasize again, if I may, the importance of enhancing southern participation in the peace process. I have met with several southern groups during the past year. We have an office in Aden, now led by a very distinguished and experienced political officer of the United Nations. And I'm grateful for the commitment that these groups show us, that their concerns about their future should be resolved in dialogue with all Yemeni groups, should be resolved as in the propriety of Yemeni politics and Yemeni rule. And that is the commitments that they give us, but we must maintain, I think, a very close relationship with them to make sure that we hear them, we listen to their aspirations. Mr. President, there are signs of hope. Nothing should remove our welcome or reduce our welcome to the redeployments made these last days in Hodeidah and the prospect of more to come. But there are also alarming signs in recent days. There are alarming signs of the war, and war has a habit of trumping peace, its impact more corrosive than the positive effect of hard-won gains towards ending wars. The ease with which progress can be reduced or removed is indeed frightening. And this is, I think, also a lesson of these days. Progress can be made, progress can be threatened. Finally, Mr. President, what I would like to ask through you, members of this Council, is first to welcome the redeployments that we have seen in Hodeidah in the last few days, to welcome the commitment of both parties to those redeployments, to urge them to work quickly with General Michael Lodersgaard to implement the remaining redeployments, and on that basis, through this Council, to work with us urgently on a political solution. And finally, that these beginnings, these early shoots, these beginnings must be protected from the threat of war. We must not allow war to take peace off the table. Thank you, Mr. President.
I thank Martin Griffith for his briefing. Now I would like to give the floor to Mr. Mark Lowcock. You have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. So I will, complementing but not repeating what Martin has just said, firstly update you on the overall humanitarian situation. Second, summarise the current challenges we face in the response. Thirdly, briefly review what the world's largest humanitarian operation, which is what we have in Yemen, has achieved and is achieving. And fourthly, set out where, at this stage, we are again seeking your help. First, on the current humanitarian situation, the spectre of famine still looms. 10 million Yemenis are still reliant on emergency food assistance to survive. A resurgent cholera outbreak has already affected 300,000 people this year. And just as a point of reference, that compares with 370,000 in the whole of 2018. Fortunately, the number of new cases seems in the last few days to be on a declining trend, but it's too soon to know if that's going to continue. Second, on current challenges, violence rages still, as Martin's just said. In the first quarter of the year, more than 900 civilian casualties were reported. And it's a sobering fact of the war in Yemen, Mr. President, that civilians are more likely to die in their own homes than anywhere else as a result of the war. The fighting also affects the aid operation. Because many main routes are not usable, travellers, humanitarian agencies and traders now rely on a patchwork of back roads and mountain passes, often going through insecure areas with numerous checkpoints. Heavier trucks, including those carrying food aid, now take more than 60 hours to travel between Sana'a and Aden. That's about four times as long as used to be the case. One of the major Aden-Sana'a routes has recently effectively closed, and without it, humanitarian operations will become even slower and even more expensive. Severe access restrictions imposed by the parties continue to be a major problem. In February and March, more than 900,000 people were affected by delays or interruptions in assistance. Restrictions on movement of goods or staff are by far the biggest cause of delay. A large majority of these incidents occurred in areas controlled by Ansar Allah-affiliated authorities, but there are too many problems arising from decisions by others as well. Over the last few weeks, we have had intensive discussions with Ansar Allah-affiliated authorities on the steps required to ensure that all assistance in Yemen is delivered in line with humanitarian principles. These discussions are progressing, and I hope that previously agreed measures, including biometric registration of beneficiaries, will soon be fully implemented. We are making some progress on some issues. On 5 May, a joint UN mission reached the Red Sea mills again for only the second time since September 2018. And I want to acknowledge the support we received for this mission, including assurances on security from all parties. The assessment team travelled from Aden to Hodeidah through government-controlled areas, and the coalition was especially helpful in facilitating these movements. This is an example of how deconfliction with the coalition continues to be a key enabler of the response across Yemen. Technicians are now working at the Red Sea mills to assess damage, repair equipment, and process whatever grain can be salvaged. That is probably going to take several weeks. Last month, Mr. President, I flagged our concerns over the Safer oil tanker. The tanker, which you will recall is moored off the coast of Hodeidah, has had no maintenance since 2015, and it is at risk of rupturing or exploding, potentially spilling 1.1 million barrels of oil into the Red Sea. Just to give you a sense of the scale of the problem, that is four times as much as was spilt in the Exxon Valdez disaster 30 years ago. All parties have now assured us that a technical assessment can proceed for the Safer oil tanker, and a UN assessment team plans to deploy to the site very soon so we can work out the best way forward to minimize the risks. Thirdly, I want to address what, despite all the problems, we are able to deliver in what, as I've said, remains the world's largest humanitarian operation. In January and February, 130 agencies worked together to provide 9.8 million people with food, water, healthcare, and other assistance. In March, the World Food Programme fed 10.6 million people. That's more than in any other previous month. In April, a cholera vaccination campaign reached 1.1 million people in Sana'a. We now have additional independent confirmation that help is reaching people. With funding from our largest donors, my office has commissioned an independent third-party monitoring exercise which covers the entire response. Data was collected from 108 districts across the country, using a mix of beneficiary surveys and key informant interviews. Thousands of people were contacted and asked what humanitarian assistance they had received. And the results tell a clear story. Some 94% of randomly selected intended beneficiaries of food aid confirmed they had received food baskets. And 96% of them said they were satisfied with the distribution process. Health services, which humanitarian agencies said they had delivered, were confirmed at 95% of facilities. Beneficiaries confirmed that water systems supported by agencies were functional 84% of the time. Mr. President, one of the questions I'm often asked is whether we're seeing a reduction in suffering and famine risk as a result of the huge relief operation. Our first goal, to be clear, has been simply to keep people alive. And I hope it's obvious that we've been reasonably successful at that. There has been no widespread famine, at least up to now. But we're also now starting to see the beginning of more positive, sustained outcomes. A year ago, agencies estimated that 107 districts were at risk of famine. On the new data available to us today, the food and nutrition situation has improved in more than half of those districts. And one-fifth of them are, as of today, no longer at risk of famine. Again, one-fifth of districts at risk of famine last year are not currently at risk. That has only been possible because last year our operation was relatively well funded. And that brings me, Mr. President, to my fourth point, my final point, which is the help we seek from you. And the most immediate issue is funding. The slight improvements I've just described will not be sustained unless donors continue to fund the relief operation. Last month, you'll recall, I told you that the 2019 UN response plan had received only 6% of the required resources, and major cuts to core relief activities were imminent. As of today, 20% of the required resources have now been provided. I want to thank in particular the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates for their funding since last month, which, as I understand it, came from the pledge that they announced last November. But there is still a long way to go. We again call on all our donors to fully disperse the pledges they made in Geneva in February. I'm looking forward to travelling to Riyadh again in the next several days to meet Saudi and Emirati officials and finalise the arrangements for the joint pledge, the new joint pledge of $1 billion that they made in Geneva. These two donors' block grant to the United Nations last year was absolutely instrumental in scaling up the aid operation, and I continue to view the approach they took as a global best practice in humanitarian support and donorship. Thank you very much indeed, Mr. President.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lowcock, for your briefing. Now I would like to give the floor to Ms. Henrietta Fore. And Henrietta, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. President. May I add my thoughts to those of Martin and Mark? Last month, a group of school children in Sana'a were doing what children around the world do every day, sitting in their classrooms, learning. Most were under the age of 9. It was almost lunchtime when a sudden incident shattered the windows. Shrapnel and broken glass flew into the classrooms. Imagine the fear that these children experienced. Imagine the horror that their parents felt for sending them to school that day, all so they could gain what every child deserves, an education. And imagine the pain endured by the families of the 14 children who never made it home at all. Or the desperate worry felt by the families of 16 others who were critically injured, left fighting for their lives in the hospital. Or the other students who will live with the trauma of that day for the rest of their lives. In any conflict, children suffer first and worst. since the fighting in Yemen began 4 years ago. 7,300 children have been killed or seriously injured. These are the verified numbers. The actual numbers are no doubt higher. The fighting still rages across 30 active conflict zones, home to nearly 1.2 million children. Each day, another 8 children will be killed, injured, or recruited to the fighting. And every 10 minutes, another child will die from a preventable cause. Like a lack of food, with 360,000 children suffering from severe acute malnutrition. In fact, half of the children under 5 years old in Yemen, there are 2.5 million children, are stunted. And stunting, as you know, is irreversible. Like a lack of a simple vaccination, with 151 children dying of diphtheria since last August, or like cholera and severe acute watery diarrhea. Despite the best efforts of the humanitarian community, including over 2 million doses of oral cholera vaccines delivered over the last year, there are 135,000 suspected cases reported so far this year among children. Over 3,300 people have died of cholera since 2017, including 153 children since January alone, a number that will increase as we head into the rainy season. And as always, the children die first. And the UN has verified the recruitment and use of over 3,000 children by all parties to the conflict since the conflict began. That number is likely much higher. A flagrant and outrageous violation of humanitarian international law. As children's lives are at risk, so too are their minds. More than 2 million children are out of school, and 1 in 5 schools have been damaged or destroyed in the fighting, a huge blow to future potential. The situation has only gotten worse. While the ceasefire has largely held in Hodeidah, other areas are seeing a rise of violence in Abs, in Haja, in Taiz, in Abdallah, and elsewhere. Hospitals, clinics, and water systems are in ruins, with half the country's hospitals and clinics destroyed. In short, the systems that every child and family needs are failing. At the same time, Yemen's economy is in freefall. A new report commissioned by UNDP shows that Yemen, already one of the least developed countries before the war, has lost an additional 2 decades worth of development gains since the war began. Mr. President, we are at a tipping point. If the war continues any longer, the country may move past the point of no return. As a global community, we must ask ourselves, can Yemen afford losing a generation of children? Can a region, indeed the world, afford the instability and crushing poverty that will result? And what will happen if Yemen descends into a full-blown famine? What happens now that the water table is so low that the wells are dry? The small aquifers are below the required well depth. In some ways, this can be worse than famine, as lack of water can sicken and kill children quickly. Are we prepared to subject a generation of children and perhaps their children to a bleak future? How long will we continue allowing Yemen to slide into oblivion? Our teams are working around the clock to prevent this from happening. As Mark has said, last year, UNICEF and our humanitarian partners treated 345,000 severely malnourished children. Children whose mid-upper arm circumference is less than 11 centimeters, or 3 adult fingers in circumference. We're delivering safe drinking water to over 5 million people every day, including 1.7 million children, in the 15 main cities through municipal water systems. We're providing cash incentives to 7,000 health workers and 135,000 teachers and school staff, as many have not been paid in over 2 years. And with key donors, We're helping to keep alive almost 9 million of the most vulnerable Yemeni people with emergency cash assistance. But this work only addresses the symptoms of the catastrophe in Yemen. To truly shape a better future for Yemen and its children, we need your engagement and influence to end this war on children now. Yemen is spiraling perilously close to the brink, to the tipping point. We call on the Council to speak with one voice to protect the children of Yemen and stop grave violations against them. We urge all parties to the conflict to open doors to immediate, long-term humanitarian access and to allow days of tranquility to vaccinate and help children. If we cannot reach them, we cannot keep them alive. We must also redouble our support for the efforts of the UN Special Envoy to reach a negotiated political solution, one that places children first. Because the longer this war continues, the more children are going to die on the world's watch. As we fail these children, we fail more than their basic rights. We fail humanity itself. When I was in Sana'a in Aden, I visited hospitals and clinics shattered by the conflict. I witnessed heart-rending struggles to survive. A newborn baby struggling to breathe in an incubator after all power was lost in the emergency room. A distraught mother with a child, thin and malnourished, begging for food. A father weeping with so little money he was forced to choose between keeping his wife alive or his children. Is this how we show our humanity to others? Mr. President, Yemen is a test of our humanity, and right now we are badly failing this test. Time is running out. We won't get another chance. 15 million children in Yemen are asking you to save their lives. Please help them. They need peace. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Henrietta, for your briefing. And I now would like to give the floor to Ambassador Gustavo Mesa Cuadra. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have the honor to report to the Security Council on the work of the committee pursuant to paragraph 19E of Resolution 2140. The last such briefing took place on 31st January 2019 in informal consultations of the Council, and hence this briefing will cover the period from 1st February to date. Mr. President, I would like to focus my remarks on my visit to Amman, Riyadh, Muscat, and Tehran from 30th March to 5 April, together with most of committee members. Two members of the panel of experts also accompanied the delegation. It was the first such visit by the chair of the 21st 40 committee. My written report on the visit was shared to committee members on 25th April, and we had the opportunity to discuss the report in a committee meeting on 10th May. I will therefore only present some highlights of the visit. Generally, I believe the visit was an important exercise to raise awareness of the purpose and scope of the sanctions measures concerning Yemen and to obtain first-hand information on their implementation. It was also helpful to encourage further interaction, dialogue, and cooperation between the 2140 committee, its panel of experts, and countries in the region, and to become acquainted with the latest political, security, and humanitarian developments in Yemen as related to the mandate of the committee. In Amman, we received general briefings on the political process and the implementation of the Hodeidah Agreement from Mr. Griffiths and General Michael Lolesgar, respectively. We also held a discussion with international non-governmental organizations on ways in which to advance the formal participation of women in the political process. Concerning the targeted arms embargo, in a field visit to Al-Karsh military base in the outskirts of Riyadh, we viewed the remnants of arms and related materials, including unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs. As described by the coalition authorities, these were either seized in Yemen or used in attacks launched against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia by the Houthis. The field visit was followed by an oral visual presentation in Riyadh. The government authorities in Muscat described the efforts they had made to prevent the transfer of illicit items from their borders into Yemen. The government authorities in Tehran stated that they were implementing Resolution 2216. Concerning the humanitarian situation in Yemen, the UN Resident and Humanitarian Coordinator, Ms. Liz Grande, and representative of the UN country team in Amman, provided a general overview. Humanitarian access and respect for international humanitarian law were also key components of the discussion held in Riyadh with coalition authorities and with President Hadi. During discussions in Amman and Riyadh, the issue of strengthening the capacity of the United Nations verification and inspection mechanism for Yemen, UNVIM, also came up. In all the meetings with interlocutors and government authorities, I emphasize the importance of continuing the dialogue and engagement with the committee, as well as extending full cooperation to the panel of experts, which was affirmed by all parties at each meeting. Information sharing between UN actors and the panel, as relevant as in accordance with the respective mandates, was also encouraged. In Muscat, government authorities noted...
Well, that's the UN Security Council special meeting on the situation in Yemen. We had Martin Griffiths, UN Special Envoy for Yemen, telling the Security Council that tangible progress has been made on Hodeidah, which can let us resume political negotiations aimed at a political solution to the conflict. That's the point that he has stressed many times. And he said that only a comprehensive solution would solve the Yemen problem, and the talk should start as soon as possible. He called for contribution of the different groups of the Yemenis, especially women, who had a great part during the Stockholm process. He wanted that to continue. He said that there are signs of hope and that nothing should reduce our actions in Hodeidah. There are also alarming signs with war still going on, and he said that progress should be made. At the same time, it should not be threatened by war, and that that the remaining redeployment should happen in Hodeidah as soon as possible. And then we had the humanitarian chief, Mark Lowcock, talking about the challenges and what the UN has achieved there in Hodeidah on the humanitarian situation. He said that 10 million Yemenis depend on food aid. Cholera is still a threat. Civilians are more likely to die in their homes rather than in war. And that he also talked about a tanker spill in Hodeidah. It has not been receiving maintenance for 3 years. So there is just a spillage which is wreaking havoc with the environment there, and it's very large in proportion, terribly large. And he compared it with a disaster, and he said it's 4 times larger than that. And he said our priority is just to keep the Yemenis alive and then try to solve some bigger problems that they have. He then asked for more funding. He said there have been big cuts to the funding, and they've just received 20% of what is promised. And then we had a lady talking about the Yemeni children, terrible stories that she told, and school children who get killed and wounded in their own classrooms while studying. She said that 7,300 children are either killed or injured in Yemen. Every 10 minutes, one child dies of a preventable cause, and half of the children below the age of 5, that is 2.5 million children, are stunted, which is something which is irreversible. She said despite all the best efforts of the UN, 135,000 suspected cases are reported among children. 2 million-plus children have been left out of schools. Half hospitals in the country are destroyed. Economy is in free fall. And she said, can Yemen afford to lose a generation of the children with things going on right now? And the country is reaching the point of no return. And the country was already poor, and now it's even 2 decades more of retrogress has been imposed because of the war. And she said, we need to reach a negotiated political solution as soon as possible to this war so that children could be protected. And she begged for the Security Council members that 15 million Yemeni children are dying and they need your urgent help. And with this, we go back to our normal programming.
Implementing a Security Council resolution. Perhaps you'd like to know how the man on the street feels about Iran's partial pullout or suspending its commitments to the JCPOA.